Welcome to Town Square. I'm Neil Milner, sitting in for Beth Ann Kozlovich. Today's guests, Peter Adler and Linda Colburn, have worked to resolve some of the biggest political and social issues, not just in Hawaii, but also in places all over the world. They've also worked on those small but nagging everyday problems that can make people crazy. And they're not politicians. They are mediators. Well, not exactly. They use their mediation skills, but in very different ways and in very different settings. And because of the work they do and the way they do it, Linda and Peter have many, many insights about cultural, politics, and leadership. Peter and Linda, welcome to Town Square.
Thanks, Neil. Pleasure
Thanks
to be here.
Good. Before we get started, let me just remind you that this is a call-in show, and the number to call if you're on Oahu is 941-3689, and on the neighbor islands, 877-941-3689. Let's start talking about an issue that you worked on recently and that is pretty high visibility, and that's the Constitutional Convention, AHA. Peter, why don't you begin by talking about what your involvement was in this?
Sure. Well, first I can say it was a real honor and a privilege to even be asked to do this as a non-Hawaiian. I was approached by Na'iaupuni, which was the sponsoring organization, and by their attorney. And they said, look, we're going to need some facilitation help on as this thing gets started. We're going to have 150 people together for a month. The stage is set for some chaos. So we really could use some help. And I said, well, only if I can bring in a good team of people who are better than me. And that included Linda Colburn and Ku'umea Aloha Gomes and Leo Linda Parlin and a couple others. So It was a really interesting challenge, and I just take great pleasure from the fact that folks rose to the challenge and accomplished something.
Linda, can you talk a little bit about the kind of work that you did there?
I think we had to anticipate a process unfolding with people we didn't know. There were 47 participants from the mainland, one from Stockholm, Sweden, one from Vietnam, and the rest were from neighbor islands and Oahu.
All Hawaiian, though.
All Hawaiian. But who had we didn't have any history with most of them. And so we had to conceptualize an approach that would allow people to get acquainted pretty quickly, have opportunity to have orderly conversations, share their ideas in ways that would broaden everyone's tolerance for ideas and concepts. And then we would have to find a way to help the group learn to make decisions, not learn to make decisions, but agree to how decisions were in fact going to be made by the group. And we also needed to have in mind some prospective guidelines that would affect their conduct as a group, so that they could be more self-determining as they took on some structure.
If they were if they were so concerned about self-determination, why did they want to bring you in? Why didn't they just say, well, we'll figure this out by ourselves because it's important?
Well, there were some, actually, I think, who actually said that and who said, you know, we really don't need any facilitators. We don't need any outsiders. We can do this ourselves. On the other hand, this 150 people represented a very broad political spectrum of views, ranging from those who really wanted to see complete independence and a deoccupation of the islands, all the way to people who said, we want to see some version of federal recognition, which was the kind of a big issue that was going on. But there were many others, too. Lots of different traditions, people representing different islands, representing different ohana. So they really, I think, very quickly understood that they're going to need to come together and they need a process. And there wasn't one in place a priori.
Linda, do you have anything to add to that?
Well, just that we spent a fair amount of time before we actually met with the group and convened the group to query through surveys to identify interests of concern, priorities that were important to them. They're thinking about decision-making methodology, also trying to find out what some of their maybe aspirations were for the outcomes. And so by doing a lot of interaction prior to the actual convening, We had some notions about what kinds of things they would be most likely to align with respect to process. We also knew what some of the key issues were. We also knew what some of the nexus points were, where there were 50-50 splits. Some thought it should be a secular process. Some thought it should be heavily spiritual. Some thought it should be in Hawaiian language. Some thought it should be only in English. Some thought it should have zero mainland Hawaiian perspective, and others thought, of course, they wanted to have that present as well. So there were lots of schisms that we got wind of early on in the process because we surveyed them a few times before we actually brought them together.
So, go ahead, Peter.
I was going to say, the other thing we did have a kind of a pretty clear strategy going into this. And part of it was that there were two big outcomes we wanted to see. First was we wanted to see a, you know, code of process or a set of ground rules or rules of engagement. And then second, we wanted them to begin to take charge by electing some kind of officers group. And we really had thought we were going to check out after the first 2 weeks and wanted to get those done in the first 2 weeks. And then we stayed on in much more of an advisory role.
So you did stay on.
We did. We were there for the whole month.
Well, let me ask you something. I mean, you know, as you describe some of this, a lot of it, it sounds like the same kinds of language and the same kinds of descriptions that you would do in other kinds of facilitation, or let's say working with big groups generically. What's different about this? What did you have to do that was different, if anything? How did these kinds of cultural and political issues affect the way you were working?
Well, you know, I think, Neil, I know you have experience in this area too. So every one of these kind of projects that, and for us it was a project, every one of these has its own characteristics, its own nuances, its own, you know, values that are at play or issues that are at odds with each other. And in this particular instance, we knew that this was going to be a historic moment. And frankly, we didn't know whether it would actually produce something, but we knew that this was a potentially historic moment in the many debates that have gone on over Hawaiian sovereignty. And I actually was very proud and it actually exceeded my own expectations. And Na'iapuni's job was to get them to the starting line and then stop. And, you know, so and that's the point at which we came in and took over.
Now, just a reminder, if you have a call, if you got some questions or a comment, 941-3689 on Oahu, 877-941-3689 on the neighbor islands. Just a couple of other related questions to that. There obviously was a lot of contention about whether Na'iapuni should go forward on this because of the fact that the formal process was stopped by the court, and this was a decision that was made to go forward. Did you have any trouble with that idea? I mean, essentially, you become part of what many people thought was the problem or perpetuating something that was, and both in the political right here, because the Grassroots Institute brought this case, and also among people who thought you should stay out of it. So what'd you do?
Well, the election, had it proceeded, would have narrowed 200-plus individuals interested in becoming delegates to a more manageable number, which was, I think, 40.
Right.
And so the original scenario was 40 people for 2 months. And when the court case surfaced and the Na'iapuni board made the determination that they would invite anyone who wanted to persist in this exercise to express that absent an election process. 154, I believe, of the participants said they would like to be part of it, even though there were changes in some of the per diem and the duration of time. So we didn't have a lot of control over that decision. And when we learned that we had 154 participants, which was three times the original target population, and that we had half the time that we were originally thinking about, I think it would be safe to say there was a little bit of anxiety that surfaced. And So we proceeded to try to think through how we might adapt our plans for getting this thing started. Mm-hmm. And we brought in additional people to assist with because of the sheer numbers of people involved.
So you really had this change from people who had originally signed on to be elected as delegates to people who were now participants. You couldn't call them delegates because there was no election. So, but they had been seated. And that was a major change in the way we'd been thinking about it. And we understood why, you know, and part of what I think we'd know how to do is accept the givens of the situation and try and move forward with it.
So you were all right with the givens. I mean, a lot of what you just said is kind of meeting management anxieties and how you adjust to it, and not the least of which was moving from 40 to 150, which is a really different dynamic. But
In two months.
That's right. But did you go through any agonizing or any kinds of?
We drank some wine.
You drank. Yeah,
we had.
Well,
a
you
drink,
always.
We
could, I mean, yeah, that's talks, another. Yeah.
Yeah. So
we'll get into that later.
take two aspirin. And,
yes. Many and, soulful exchanges.
That's well, yeah, but that's. I mean, I'm asking about soulful exchanges beforehand. You know, when they came to you and said, "Would you like to do this?" Does it enter into your conversation about? Well, is this really a process that we consider to be a legitimate process or that we even want to make a judgment about? Linda?
Well, I'm my way of thinking about taking on projects is probably a little different from a lot of people's. However, my thinking was that people expected it to be filled with conflict and a lot of difficulties, and people seem to have somewhat low expectations. And I thought, well, if that's the expectation and we are still standing at the end of the process, anything we do above those low expectations is going to be considered significant. And so in terms of risk, there were certainly moments that were difficult. But in terms of risk, the group surpassed my expectations in just extraordinary ways. And the quality of the leadership that manifested, the ability to coalesce around a structure, the ability to, in smaller groups, talk about ideas, knowing that they may have completely mutually exclusive positions. Their ability to do that was extraordinary, given what we often see.
It had actually never happened before.
Mm-hmm.
It was new. I mean, I think it was quite new to see that actually occur. There were also... I think one of the things about that I saw was and something it's about the dynamics of groups like this, that there is we're trying to tap into a collective wisdom. And to do that, you have to have some collective learning, and many different kinds of learning are going on. And the first week, there were some brilliant professors who came in and brought in by Na'iya Puni to give talks on constitutional law, on historical pieces. You know, that was a stage setting and a learning. And then there was also this quiet learning about each other. And it turns out a lot of them are related. So that plays a role, that these are clans and people who are cousins from different islands. And so there's this discovery process that's going on.
We have a call. Michael from Honolulu asked that we talk about TMT, which is exactly what I was going to do. So, Michael, hold on to the line if you want. We're going to talk about TMT right now, and then if you have a comment, go ahead. TMT, the 30-meter telescope. Peter, you've been working on this issue for much longer than almost anybody else who's been involved. Why don't you talk about what your involvement was and how you've gone about doing this?
So I was involved in this in 2007. When the 30-meter telescope corporation was trying to really think through whether they could actually build this in Hawaii.
You were working for the Keystone.
I was the CEO of a group called the Keystone Center in Colorado, a 60-person organization. Does the same kind of work in a variety of areas that are similar, environment, energy, health. And we were approached by the Gordon and Betty Moore Foundation. Gordon Moore is one of the inventors of the microchip. He's Moore's Law, if you're familiar with computers and expanding capacities. And he's also a resident of the Big Island, and he's very interested in science. And it's his passion. And so I was approached by the foundation, and they said at Keystone, could you folks help us do a little diligence, not the financial diligence, but can we get this through politically and culturally? And so one of my colleagues and I did a lot of interviews and a lot of work, and we produced a report that's now a public report. And
this was when, in about 2008, that the report got produced?
2007, late 2007, I think it came out. I'd have to look. But basically, we said, here are the mousetraps, the potholes, the problems that you are going to encounter politically and culturally based on interviews. So we'd done a lot of interviewing to understand those that in very specific ways. What we didn't anticipate, of course, was in the last several years, a whole new generation of young Hawaiians, very activist and very media savvy. So you would never see that in the report because we couldn't have anticipated that.
But what you did anticipate was virtually everything else that's become an issue in this. When I looked at the report, I was amazed all the way from the way the university is mumbling and fumbling over this for periods of time and all of the other issues. So essentially what it sounds like is that you all of those were already there, and the new one was the catalyzing effect of the new generation of demonstrators.
And what we had identified in the report, again, it's a public document, is the gauntlet that any new enterprise like this would have to run in order to do it. It didn't matter whether it was ceded land issues, whether it was lease issues, whether it was the numbers of telescopes up there, whether it was the cultural piece of having a very large telescope on the very summit. It's now actually, I think, moved down a little bit in their planning. That's been my only involvement with it. I've had some back conversations with different people about it. But that has been my involvement.
Would you do more?
I would under the right circumstances, but this is really now in the administrative law arena. And, you know, I think it's going through its process. It's rough and messy and complicated, but it has to run its course because the Supreme Court has said this is what you got
to
do.
It may have to run its course, but it's likely that whatever the course is, that it's going to just reiterate the same issues and the same dynamics again, right?
I think that's right. Yeah. I think in the end, there's still those who are, and this is true with many political issues like this, there may be 10 or 15% on each end of the spectrum of any given issue who have drawn very tough lines in the sand, and there are a lot of people in the middle, a lot of people and a lot of voices. This is whether it's the silent majority or the it goes by many names. And so right now the issue is in the hands of the courts with people who have brought the case and are defending the case.
Linda, I know you haven't been as directly involved here, but you certainly have a perspective on these kinds of issues on the basis of your other work and everything else. What do you see here? What do you see about the way this is playing out? What do you see about things that might happen or things that could be done?
Well, my telescope experience is pretty much confined to the Outrigger project, which was proposed by NASA. And that, I think, was in the early 2000s. And one of my observations—
The innocent days of telescopes.
Yeah. Well, actually, it was at that point that I first became aware of the fact that commitments had been made to limit the number of telescopes to a small number many times. And each time, it was like, oh, okay, we promised this is the last one. And so when I was invited by the NASA people to do the community meetings, what I heard were things like, you guys said that was the last one, and now you're here again. Two, you said you'd have meetings with us to let us know what's going on so we could feel like we had some engagement around this, and you're not meeting with us. And three, you guys are doing stuff up there that's not cool with us culturally. And four, all of those billions of dollars promised in the economic benefits, exactly how does that trickle down to the average person on the street?
So it's same-same in lots of ways.
It's same-same. But I think had public interaction occurred earlier and on a regular basis, it might not have elevated to the level of contention that it ultimately did. Because the longer you wait between sessions, the more contentious the meetings ultimately become. And the more contentious they are, the less inclined you are to want to do it again. So I think there was a cycle that started. And because of that, there were no significant and structured opportunities for people to have any kind of dialogue that would cause them to feel they had an impact or were even respected sufficiently to be kept in the loop. So I think that was sort of a tactical issue that happens in a lot of cases, the absence of consultation and inclusion and seats at the table.
You know, there's a larger story in all of this, whether it's the TMT or the rail or super ferries. We have a long history of not, at least in recent times, of not being able to do big projects very well. And I don't totally understand all the dynamics of why that's so. We know we have very unhappy communities who feel consistently left off. We have declining confidence in government institutions, all institutions, whether it's banks or universities or anything. So there's something afoot right now, and we just don't see that we have a good ability to create the kind of communications and the kind of discussions and fact-driven conversations where people really get together and they say, you know, what are the facts that should inform this? So we're in a very strange time right now on this stuff.
We'll come back to this idea of fact-driven conversations later because, we'll come back maybe in the context of GMO, but just generally. But it's as you describe it, it sounds as if that what you really have going here with the telescope is partially a telescope issue and partially an issue about culture and science. And we'll also get back to that later. But when you start reframing it, it starts to sound like issues of political leadership. By the way, when you were thinking about what you were saying about large projects here, I can't think of any large project that this place has actually completed on budget, on time, in the 40-some years that I've lived here. So say more about those kinds of things. What is it? Is it the leadership? Is it that we have too many expectations for government here? Are we different from the rest of the United States when it comes to those things?
Well, we're small. We're a small place. We're isolated. We have a lot of cross-cultural interactions and a lot of layers to that, and we have a very resurgent Hawaiian culture, and so I think there are some interesting special issues that we have. Just like people like to say we're a special place, we got special problems, mm-hmm. and special issues, and I do think all of those things play in the politics, cultural leadership, okay. political leadership, all those things are at play when one of these issues is alive and running.
If you just joined us, the guests are Peter Adler and Linda Colberg, and the number to call is 941-3689 on Oahu and 877-941-3689 on the Neighbor Islands. Michael from Honolulu. Go ahead, Michael.
Hello, Dr. Adler. I have two questions for you. The first has to do with the TMT. Kalina Halabusa was instrumental in getting this project started as one of the 2008 shovel-ready projects and had everybody on board, including the Hawaiians. And now we're going back through the approval process, and we're going through a permit issue. If the permit process goes forward and a permit is issued, would you be supporting the putting in of the TMT on the top of Mauna Kea? And the second issue I have for you is you have been at least two, if not three times, nominated to be on the Board of Regents. If you had been on the Board of Regents when this came up, would you have approved or not approved of the TMT? And thank you. I'll take my questions off the air.
Peter will answer while Linda and I leave the room. Peter, go ahead. Those are good questions,
give
Michael.
Me the first,
especially since you didn't ask me those questions.
Restate the first question, if you will.
Michael, restate your first question. Okay.
The
first question was about the process of TMT and whether, if it weren't for the involvement of the Hawaiians, if it would have gone through. I think that's, with the Hawaiian activist, if it would have gone through.
To be blunt about it, to be candid, I think in the case of a number of these big projects, the state process has been confusing to people. I mean, I think I don't have a dog in the fight. Let me just tell you, I don't favor or disfavor TMT. I'm an eternal optimist that people can find ways to do better than they're doing. I really am, and I think Linda is too. And But my sense is that there are solutions. They will not satisfy the extremes. They will not satisfy scientists who want to be dismissive of a culture, and they will certainly not satisfy cultural practitioners and proponents who think it's a complete desecration to have any kind of technology on the mountain. So the question, again, is there room for some common solutions? I continue to believe there are, and I know of examples that have been just as tough culturally where they've actually produced solutions. And so there are other examples elsewhere. The Board of Regents, I don't know. I don't know what I would have done. I mean, luckily I wasn't on there. So, you know, I mean, I do remember, I think Nainoa Thompson was one of the votes against this. And I've never talked to Nainoa. I don't know if he, you know, what his views were.
Well, let me change the question a little bit. What kind of questions would you think the Board of Regents should be asking about this?
Well, I've now or
you're now. Well, both. Well, yeah, now.
I think there are that kind of soul searching is going on. I think the decommissioning, the promises of the past have to be kept. And they will acknowledge that there have been promises made and they weren't kept up. And so that's part of the what has to go on.
What's that, taking down some of the?
Yes. Yeah. And, you know, there have been apologies for that. And I think the university is in good faith trying to rectify a bad history on this issue. And bless them for doing that. That's the starting point, is to say, well, you know, we made some mistakes. Let's clean it up. Let's get it done. So what the Board of Regents' involvement is now, it's not clear to me. And where the initiative is coming from, not clear to me. How much of that sits with the governor, with Chancellor Straney, with President Lassner? I'm just not clear.
Linda.
I just wanted to go back to something Michael said in his question, which was the people had everything lined up. The Hawaiians were lined up and the regulators were lined up and the state was lined up. I think how community members define being aligned and how office holders or policymakers may define being aligned and ready are very different. And so affirmative responses from a couple of people from a community may not be a reliable indicator of the full spectrum of opinion in that community. And so I think one of the things that is frequently a surprise in public sector conflicts is that, oh, but this seems so reasonable. And number one, and they haven't actually heard much of what has come in response to a proposal. Secondly, perhaps the consultation hasn't been as extensive as might be helpful. And third, appearance in many instances is that, okay, so no doesn't mean no. No from a community still means they're going to do what they want anyway. And so I think that undermines confidence in processes generally, and I think it contributes to the sort of incremental increases in community anger and lack of confidence in its institutions. So it's a dynamic that's worsening with repetition. So I think the way to get around that is to reexamine what kind of engagement constitutes meaningful engagement and what kinds of processes are truly transparent and transparent as it's defined from a community perspective.
Of course, you can't exactly sit back and do this in like a seminar room. We have another call that wants to jump in on this. Robert from Kaneohe, go ahead. Hi, Robert.
Yes, hi. This is Robert Harris. I'm the former director of the Sierra Club, so had some mild involvement in some of these projects. So
yes, Robert. Mild is a modest word. Go ahead.
Thank you. You know, one thought that it has occurred to me is the role of government in approving these projects. You know, typically, government is supposed to be an objective process that gives, you know, the community some confidence that they're considering the laws and considering it impartially, and also sometimes can serve in the role of kind of a mediator, hearing both sides and trying to find a reasonable solution in the middle. And I think with TMT and Super Ferry, one of the failures was the fact that government was one of the chief proponents of the projects. You know, you had Governor Lingle being very, very supportive of the Super Ferry and Governor Abercrombie being very, very supportive of TMT. And I do think a lot of the procedural problems happened as a result of that. And I guess, you know, again, maybe I'm making this more of a statement, but I guess also ask as a question, you know, do you see that, you know, can government or should government be a primary proponent of major projects, particularly where there's perhaps a private business interest that stands to gain in those two particular circumstances? It's not a typical public infrastructure project.
Linda, what do you have to say about that?
Well, I think it goes back to that issue. If the community expresses reservations and those are dismissed and are not in any visible way incorporated into the final decision making, I think that's problematic. And secondly, I think in the case of Superferry, the proponents of the project, the sponsors of the project, relied to their detriment on the state's assurances. Nah, no need, just the EA, you know, yeah, EA is enough, you know. No. So I think they took at face value a statement or representation that these are not likely to be problems, and so you don't have to do as deep diligence as might otherwise be the case.
Well, I want to turn this around a little bit and just look at both sides, which is what we do anyway. So here's the other perspective, which is if you are a TMT or you're the Super Ferry Corporation or you're, you know, another developer and you are relying on the state to navigate you through and say, here's the process. Robert's right. I mean, the question is, do they have that right? And we're learning that they don't. Very often the advice is bad. But the other thing is, well, how actually do you gain consent? How do you get consent from a community? And especially in one that is fractious and divided and we have very different, and it's demographically changing. So
yes.
Lots of you know, it's a challenging issue. I worked on one project when I was on the mainland where the government was trying to site biosafety labs, which are, in this case, it was a BSL-3, which is a place where they can deal with certain pathogens and infectious diseases.
I think
diseases.
They were talking about putting one here.
It didn't go.
Yes.
And there were universities competing for this because there was a fair amount of prestigious research money that would come in. So a consortium of universities bid on this out of Argonne, which is one of the Department of Energy labs, national labs. But one of the stipulations was they said to win this BSL grant, you need to get the consent of the community. And so Argonne was really scratching its head and saying, how are we going to do that? And we actually went around and talked to people and said, how do you do it? We asked them. We didn't say we know how to do it. And they said, well, here's the groups that you need to get their sign-off. And there were groups. There were Leagues of Women Voters, and there were the equivalent of community boards, and there were groups. And yet they had to go to every one of those things and say, here's what we're doing, answer their questions. And there was a lot of sort of factually wrong information floating out there. And actually, they won. In the end, they proceeded.
You know, that might be an effective way of getting political consent, but it's really not popular sovereignty. I mean, it's a realistic assumption that you get consent of a community by working through groups. That's not always a way that works, and I'm not sure how well that would work with TMT when it's hard. Every one of those groups you mentioned is a well-organized group that thinks process and that probably thinks in a fairly linear way. That's very different than working with a group of protesters, whether they're Hawaiian protesters or any other kind of protesters or people that were out at the Capitol protesting against same-sex marriage.
It's not either or. I mean, there's no reason why you can't run a good outreach program to groups that are inchoate and that are not formal elected bodies, formal NGOs, former neighborhood boards, that kind of stuff.
Well, you also, it's an unfair question for me to put that way because it's the hardest thing in democratic political theory is how do you
and
get
And we've been
consent.
Waiting for you professors to give us a good answer.
Well, there's
too.
A book that I actually just wrote about today that where they get up to the last chapter and where it's a whole critique about the old way. And then they say, we really don't have time to get into the new one yet. It's a great book, but it has it's the difference between an A minus and an A.
Neil, if I could weigh in.
Sure.
On a microcosm level, the Kawainui Marsh project, supposed to be 35 people talking about and reacting to a proposed plan for that area. The word got out and 300 people showed up for the meeting. By luck, I had met the day before with some people who have developed software that allows anyone with a smartphone or device to weigh in anonymously, to set questions. And we found some interesting outcomes by using that tool. One, we would take comments from the audience, and we got three kind of sort of cranky, not necessarily even on point comments from the live feedback. But when people were using their devices, we had 20 or 25 responses that were actually more focused and bereft of the edginess and the snarkiness. And when we went through this meeting, we knew we couldn't hear from everyone who wanted to speak, but they knew that if they used their devices to send their comments and questions up, which we could scroll through in real time and show the audience, it began to change their feelings about the fairness of the playing field. So I think the use of new technology is something to think about when you want to do decision-making on complex issues, especially if you want to get opinions from different islands by using Skype and GoToMeetings and other kinds of things. But using this meeting sift process took 300-plus people who were really, really kind of annoyed, got them into a position where they were more prone to listen to the presentations. And we had an audit trail of their feedback, which was very different from what we heard from the audience.
Very different from the old town meetings that assumed that people would learn from each other through public discussion, where you started here. Remember, the number to call is 941-3689 on Oahu. Neighbor Islands, 877-941-3689. And our guests are Linda Colburn and Peter Adler.
By the way, that that same technology we brought into the Na'iapuni Aha. So it got, and it took a little while for everybody to get comfortable with it, but it was another way to engage this group of very diverse Native Hawaiians, very diverse.
Using the smartphone.
Exactly.
Let's switch over to another issue that you've worked specifically on GMO, but you've both worked on science and agricultural issues. And let's start, Peter, by talking about the fact-finding project that you did for Kauai.
Well, it's not quite done. It should be done by the middle of next week. We expect to transmit the final report on May 25th. Next Wednesday, I think it is. And this has been a year.
On budget, on time, Peter.
No. No. Not on budget. Way over budget for me. So, but that's fine, because this has been as much a labor of love as anything else. And I have been very interested in how we bring facts into complex debates that are science intensive, but they're also politically very, very difficult and challenging. And the GMO issue is a classic example of it. It's not the only one, but it's a classic example where we have people on all sides who are mining facts for things that they want that will bolster their opinion.
And you were trying to do what with facts?
Some joint fact-finding. We had to formulate a set of questions, and then we had to say what is the kind of factual information we can bring to bear to inform answers to those questions.
So the people who were anti-GMO attack it, and the people who were pro-GMO attack it, both sides for being unbiased.
Yeah. Cannonballs and spears and arrows are just flying.
You know,
the
cliche that's usually used, which underestimates the whole dynamic, is that if you get criticized from both sides, you did a pretty good job. But it seems to me the more significant issue about science and about persuasion generally is that people do not accept or even consider or even want to have anything to do except to argue with facts that differ from their pre-existing opinions. I mean,
that's right. And people, we know that there's a lot of unconscious bias and my side bias, and people will go out and select the facts that suit their dispositions. And so that's one of the things that you're trying to combat in a group. I mean, the first challenge is, can you assemble a diverse group? Second, can you get people who are reasonably conversant with how you read scientific literatures, who can, you know, go out and find data or are willing to monger through a lot of data? So there's a lot of different challenges in this. And I have to say, I think we're still learning how to do this. This has been certainly not a perfect
Well, the
project.
Social science isn't very helpful, other than telling the social science and psychology is really pretty good in saying how difficult that process is. The dynamic of non-persuasion and the fact that you sometimes become more negative when you have to confront facts that are different.
Well, not only that, when facts come in that are contrary, sometimes it hardens your position.
Yes, that's what I meant. Yeah, you just said it more clearly, for sure. But it's interesting that your faith in this process still has something to do with the belief that you can overcome some of that. That not to say that the truth will out, but there'll be some kind of some kind of agreement, even though this is a very deeply social psychological issue. Yes, no. You said it. I didn't.
Yeah. I thought that's what you were saying.
Yeah, the private moments of a mediator when you say what you really think about your clients.
No, I don't think that.
No, he doesn't think that.
Neil, the other thing I'd like to add is that if you design a process that gives people a lot of face-to-face time and they have to spend time together and become better acquainted and see each other as people as opposed to the enemy, that you change the dynamic and that changes the malleability of thought, of positions. So if people objectify one another and have no relationship and that there's no change in the relationship, then there's not a lot of changing in thinking, facts or no facts.
You know, that's interesting because there is a kind of, I don't remember the fancy social science name, but one of the things that they've been working with that seems to be fairly effective in changing people's minds about things that they were fairly basic against, gay rights and some other things, is essentially walking a mile in somebody else's shoes,
right,
where you get people to imagine what it would be like. But, you know, when I learned mediation and when I learned facilitation, you were out of the room before that kind of thing would happen. You finished, you finished your job and said maybe they should call you, and here's a list of things that we put in the parking lot, which means they would never, ever be considered again. So is there a skill here that you're learning on the job? Are you going to now have to do more of this kind of?
I think you very accurately described the process. You show up for a meeting for an hour and a half, you have some discussion, and then you go, and the real dialogue happens in the parking lot after the meeting.
Literally.
And so I think the essence of process design is there's no shortcut to having the parking lot conversation, but the art is having that occur, creating the circumstances under which the parking lot conversation can happen in the room. And that only happens, well, not only, but things that increase the probability of that happening are giving people time together, not focusing on the issue that they've gathered to address, but just interpersonal time. So cooping people up in a van and making them drive around to site visits has almost as much value as the site visit itself.
And you turn the air conditioning off.
Well, you can do any number of things. You can simulate a flat tire if you really want to. But,
well, okay.
But my point is there's no shortcut to changing how people see one another and feel about one another. And so I think the process has to take into consideration how do you get people to be with each other as individuals.
Well, speaking of that and speaking of parking lots, and let me give the phone number before I follow up on that. The phone number to call is 3689 on Oahu, 877-941-3689 on the Neighbor Islands. Parking lots, getting people to change their minds. That reminds me of some of the work that you did when you were the administrator many years ago now of Maile Land, where you fundamentally had to learn how to use the skills you had in very different ways in very different settings. Tell us about that.
Well, it's a good example of having mediation skills but not having a table or a room in which to conduct the mediation. It happens on the fly. And a lot of it is about modeling behaviors. A lot of it is about stopping the escalation of conflicts.
So you were the administrator. I can't remember. Were you a live-in administrator at the time?
No. No, I think that would have been more than I could have handled.
But you were the administrator of a relatively new public housing project out in Maile that had gotten off to a pretty rough start and had some really significant tenant problems in there, and that's where you stepped in, and that's where people thought you were Linda Koble.
That's right.
And that's why they let you work there.
It's like, yeah. I don't have to listen to you because Linda Koble's the manager over here. And so there was that confusion for a while. But the same skills that one uses in a formal mediation are the same things you do on the fly. You still have to slow down the dispute.
Can you give an example?
Two people arguing, two neighbors arguing, and, you know, walking up and distracting them so that they stop arguing. So one might be, have you considered the socioeconomic implications of the discussion you're about to get into here? And they look at me like, what? And then I could say, okay, so help me understand what's going on over here. Can you tell me what's going on? And then, Troy, wait, don't interrupt. Can I hear from this one? And then, also, from your point of view, what's going on with you? No, Troy, wait, give him a chance to tell the story.
I believe one time you did it by saying you were the pizza delivery person.
That's correct. I pretended I was the pizza delivery person because I heard an argument inside a unit that was clearly getting to a point of physical altercation, and I had reason to believe that there was a weapon in the apartment. So I just knocked on the door, and the guy opened the door. I said, pizza delivery. And the guy said, well, I won't tell you what he said, but he slammed the door. And then I knocked on it again, and I said, I was confused about the toppings. And he says, I don't know what you're talking about. But that got him off beating on his girlfriend or his wife enough to change the rhythm of the dynamic and to stop the abusive behavior and to separate the parties and create some safety, and then to try to, again, unpack the issues and maybe try to stabilize the situation in some fashion. It wasn't always pretty, and it wasn't always successful, but I think it was a great place to demonstrate the efficacy of some core mediation practices.
So we have to. Well, Peter, go ahead.
I think one of the things that we're kind of touching on is the fact that mediation isn't one thing. Facilitation isn't one thing. There are some common elements to all of them. And Linda's putting her finger on a few of these core functions, whether it's how do I get people to stop for a minute so we can have a discussion or convene people or de-escalate things, depending on what the nature of the issue is. And then how do we get people to talk, maybe listen to each other, and then how do we get them into the problem-solving mode? Those are functions. It doesn't matter whether this is a highfalutin mediation of a Supreme Court case or whether it's in Maili land. There's some core functions that just happen. And that's where I think this isn't a profession. It's sort of a craft. And it isn't for everybody. I know that. I mean, I just tell you, there's some people think this, my wife, among others, who say this is loony. Why would you ever put yourself in the middle of this stuff? It could be dangerous. People are throwing rocks from both sides. So,
Nancy from Hamakua. Go ahead.
Oh, thanks for taking my question. So I was wondering, Peter, if in all your discussions that you had with the different sides on Kauai that you're speaking about and how hard it was for them to move on, you know, their belief. I was wondering if you came across and you found any common interests that were between both groups, even though they seemed far apart, that there was actually some threads of common interests running into that could be built on.
Yeah, that's a nice question. You know, I do think that there was an interest in trying to bring some kind of fresh discussion, that there was frustrations on all sides, that the things that had been going on in the 2491 hearings with red shirts and blue shirts was, it might have been, you know, lots of excitement around it, and certainly in the throes of a legislative battle, but it was dissatisfying to a lot of people, maybe to some. So there were some who loved it and thrived on it, or whatever the right word is. Yeah, they got off on it. So, but I think one of the things that got going was that there were some people who were hungry for some alternative ways. And one of the tenets of this joint fact-finding is you can't just come in with an opinion. You got to put some evidence on the table. You got to show us the research that you're working on, the data, and we can have a discussion about that. And we can debate that. We can debate the veracity of it, the strength of it. That's the essence of this. Let's agree on the questions. Let's mine whatever research and whatever data sets we can find.
How about common interests on other things? Mountain ball, cousins, those kinds of things that cement people.
I think that happens actually all the time. It's one of the paths. There are some solutions that come about just because people are exhausted and they just want to bring it to an end. But there are many more where people actually do discover some common element. It may be the common humanity that Linda was talking about that says, hey, you know, you're not such a bad person. You're not a monster. Or it may be that we are related and we, you know, we need to talk with each other a little bit more. Yeah. So it could be there are lots of forms of it.
We have another call. Leslie from Cooler. Go ahead, Leslie.
Hi, thanks.
Sure.
You know, I'm listening and I'm looking to the future and in developing our future leaders, the emerging leaders who are coming in to kind of carry the torch as we go forward in all the different sectors for Hawaii. And beyond mediation skills, what are those leaders going to have to learn in terms of competencies, hard and soft skills, to build capacity so they can craft and facilitate meetings of this nature?
Bless you, Nancy. That was going to be my big finish. So let's go now. Linda, go ahead.
Well, I think it's a great question. And I think critical thinking is imperative to listening. There's a difference between hearing and listening. Three, I think most people who have a passionate interest in an area and a strong position also have some intellectual curiosity about learning more about that issue. So exposing people to emerging information and latest information is sometimes a good way to get people's eye off their sole position. But I think if future leaders can master the listening skills, the critical thinking skills, be open to new information, and I think lastly, having some process expertise rather than running strictly on instinct, I think they'll be in a much more robust position to deal with issues irrespective of the magnitude of the conflict.
You know, those are absolutely right. That's my list, too. The only thing I would add to that is, and it's an area that I love teaching. I do workshops. I teach one course a year at the university. And the course I really love teaching is this more sophisticated advanced course on negotiation. And I actually think negotiation and problem solving, understanding about that. So the communication skills and the diplomacy skills for leaders are really critical. And some leaders can make their bones without that. I mean, they can rise up because they're angry and, you know, they can mobilize and so on. But I think the more enduring leaders, the ones we really like are and admire and seem to get a lot more done, are able to do the communication, but they also have a nose for the solution. They know how to get there, or they can figure out how to listen. And it's a little bit of a jazz. It's not, you know, a linear process.
Pick one of those. Doesn't have to be from here that you think does that. Some leader, some political leader, social leader somewhere that acts that way.
I think, for example, on the national level, Clinton was masterful at some of this stuff. He was. He's very protean. He's able to change. Now, some may say, well, he's such a shapeshifter, you don't know who he is and you don't know what he stands for. But he was very skillful. And, you know, one of the things is Bill, and I have my own criticisms of Bill Clinton, so don't misunderstand that. But here's a guy who likes people. He actually likes people. He actually enjoys interacting with people, and I'm sure he's tired at the end of the day. But very skilled negotiator, very skilled problem solver. There are others, too, I think, who are like that, who've risen up and become political leaders, good political leaders.
I got some word from Mike that there are a couple of biohazard operations on – one at UH and one at Japscom at the medical school. So thanks, Mike, for giving us that clarification. Linda, you have anybody that you admire for this kind of stuff? Here's why I'm asking. I've heard you especially talk about and write about leadership, and these answers strike me as being a little bit polite and not all that pointed and kind of taking the politics out of the answer. You know, I'm not saying political ideology out of the answer. I'm saying someone, and I'll toss out an example that you might want to work with, and that's Billy Conoy before he got into trouble. There was something about Billy Conoy's style that was captivating and that was, I can't, you know, I don't read motives. That's not good. But he certainly could convince a group of people. He was sort of an excitable Bill Clinton in many ways.
Well, I think that's right. And actually, just to make a point out of it, Mayor Canoy was actually one of the people who set in play and championed a big joint fact-finding we did on geothermal issues in Pune and the health impacts of hydrogen sulfide. So he's used his office as a platform, as a bully pulpit for actually trying to move towards solutions. And he had a pretty good instinct for it. He could see how it was all tied up in the county legislature or in mayoral politics, and he said, let's do something different.
I would add that rather than name individuals, I would say that some of the people who come to mind are people who are capable of subordinating their personal interests to the collective benefit of the larger community, genuinely. And secondly, they're authentic. They're not doing the talking points that are politic, but are speaking in a way that suggests that there's resonance between what they're saying and what they actually believe. And I think the third thing is that consistency in terms of values and expression of core principles. There's some people that are very stable and they don't vary as the wind's directions change. And so I think those are the ones that, in my mind, are putting leadership of a different kind forward. And I think they can engender the kind of trust from community members and others and colleagues that can make them more able to reach resolution to complex issues.
Let me go back for the last few minutes to the more personal, smaller level and say you two have worked on an enormous number of important issues that we haven't even touched upon here. I want to give you a chance to pick, each of you, to pick one of those issues, talk about it, and why you think it's important. You don't have a long...
As an issue?
As an issue or the hardest issue, anything like that. Pick out one of the others. I know, Peter, you've did a lot of stuff at the Keystone Foundation from working on mines in New Guinea and all of those sorts of things. And Linda, I know your list is long, too. So, Peter...
Well, actually, that is one that was a remarkable experience and a remarkable outcome. And there's a long story about how I got involved.
This is the mining company in New Guinea.
Yes, it is. Yes. And it's a nasty history. It's one of the world's worst environmental disasters. And this was a compensation discussion for 60,000 people up and down a river that had been pretty well contaminated, stuffed, as they like to say down in Australia. And this was a compensation discussion, and it involved 18 different language groups and tribal groups that didn't much like each other. But they also didn't much like the mine, and they didn't much like the government. And we got everybody around the table, and it took 2 years. And at the end of it, there was a $300 million package of solutions that came out of it. One of the first things I did was found Papua New Guinean partners to work with.
Linda.
I'm really struggling.
You're going to have to struggle for another 30 seconds or so.
I will pick one where a corporation had to deal with discovery of Ivy or Hawaiian bones on a site where excavation was occurring. And I was really impressed with the way in which they were open to suggestions about how to reach out to the lineal and cultural descendants to engage them in dialogue about what should happen to the Ivy. And it was a tough process. It was not always a polite process.
Not pretty.
But I gave them enormous credit for, one, trusting that the advice they were given was somewhat useful, and that they were actually prepared to integrate, but they had learned from the groups.
Thanks. I want to thank our guests, Linda Colburn and Peter Adler. This is Neil Milner sitting in for Beth Ann Kozlovich. Thank you for listening to Town Square. Have a good night. We'll be back next week.